Welcome to Knowing God in the Word, brought to you by the Word of Truth Ministry, publishers of Seed and Bread. I'm your host, Bob Juno, with Bible teacher Nathan Johnson. This radio program is for the purpose of helping listeners fulfill the greatest need we have as believers, to know God. Today, Nathan will continue his teaching series in the book of the Song of Solomon with The Return of Solomon. And now, Bible teacher Nathan Johnson.
Thanks, Bob. We have been considering the Song of Solomon. And I've said that I believe that this book is written in the form of a drama in five acts. It's like we're reading a play script, like when you read Shakespeare. Anything but his sonnets, of course. But of course, when you read Shakespeare, there are things like notes on who is speaking, or stage direction, what's happening. But this is just the dialogue. So it's a long series of dialogue without even any marks for who is speaking. Although you can tell somewhat from the Hebrew by the male or female pronouns being used. But it's very difficult, and we have to try to figure out the story just from the dialogue. Now, I believe that the story it's telling is about a love triangle. And it is between a country girl, her country boy lover, to whom she is betrothed, and King Solomon, who tries to steal her away from her betrothed lover. And in it, we see an example of the kind of love and loyalty we should have toward God, and of the kind of love he has for us. Well, last time we saw that Solomon had seen the country girl and fallen for her, and had taken her into his train as he was heading back for Jerusalem. However, she remained loyal in her heart to her shepherd boy lover, who had come and managed to get an interview with her, and she had told him she was remaining loyal to him. And then we saw last time she had recalled to the court ladies events from their courtship from earlier in her life, or maybe earlier in that same year. But now we are beginning Act 3 of this five-act drama, starting in Song of Solomon, chapter 3 and verse 6, in which Solomon's courtly procession arrives back at Jerusalem. So in Song of Solomon 3:6 we read, "Who is this coming out of the wilderness, like pillars of smoke, perfumed with myrrh and frankincense, with all the merchants' fragrant powders?" So here we have some people speaking, and these seem to be inhabitants of Jerusalem. And they are commenting to each other as Solomon and his train, his royal caravan, arrive at Jerusalem from the wilderness. Now the first Jerusalemite who speaks asks who is coming. He sees some procession coming, and he sees the dust they're kicking up like pillars of smoke coming, and he's wondering who it is. But it seems almost that he can smell them before he can see them, because he mentions that they're perfumed with myrrh and frankincense and with all the merchants' fragrant powders. Now, if we remember how rich Solomon was, how wealthy he was, and at the time, bathing was not really a common thing. There wasn't that much water to bathe with, so you used a lot of oil and a lot of perfume to cover up the smell. And so a wealthy person like Solomon, it seems that his caravan was so covered with perfumes that you could almost smell them before you could see them. They would put out such an odor. And so this Jerusalemite notices the pleasant, the fragrant odor of all the myrrh and frankincense and the merchants' fragrant powders that Solomon and his procession are putting out. Now verse 7. "Behold, it is Solomon's couch, with 60 valiant men around it, of the valiant of Israel." So here a second Jerusalemite speaks up, and he doesn't notice so much the fragrance as he notices Solomon's couch. Now, of course, we wouldn't imagine a couch traveling along in a procession, but this is probably more what we would call a sedan chair or a palanquin. So he notices the magnificent sedan chair Solomon is riding in. And of course, there's a seat or a couch inside that sedan chair. But he notices this sedan chair, and then he notices that there are 60 valiant men around it of the valiant of Israel. And of course, this is what we would call Solomon's honor guard. His honor guard, his personal guard. And kings, of course, all throughout history have had an honor guard, or a personal guard of people who are always around him and guarding the king's person. And even our Lord Jesus Christ seems to have that. Whenever we see him on the throne, in the various visions of the throne in the Bible, he is surrounded by people like the living creatures, the cherubim, and the elders and the angels surrounding his throne. He has his honor guard. Of course, the honor guard, you want them to be loyal, but sometimes they'll be a disloyal member of the honor guard. We know even Jesus Christ had a guardian cherub who covers part of his honor guard, and yet he fell away from him and became what we call Satan. He was part of his honor guard, and he turned against him. But Solomon had an honor guard of 60 valiant men. They were of the most valiant men of the land of Israel. Verse 8, they all hold swords, being expert in war. Every man has his sword in his thigh because of fear in the night. So all these honor guards have swords, and they know how to use them. They're experts in war, in the craft of war and warcraft, so they can use these swords to great effect. Now, this doesn't mean that they're carrying their swords in their hands, because he says every man has his sword in his thigh. So their swords are in the sheath. But he has his sword, he says, because of fear in the night, or in the nights. It's actually plural in Hebrew. Well, at night, bad things can happen. You might worry about assassins, you might worry about someone attacking the king. So they have their swords just in case. But really, this was, as we've discussed, one of the safest times there was in Israel. David had defeated all Israel's enemies. There was peace all around. The nation largely was following the Lord, so morality was probably at an all-time high. So there really wasn't a whole lot of danger. And yet, if there was any danger, these honor guard men were ready for it. Verse 9, of the wood of Lebanon, Solomon the king made himself a palanquin. So here a third Jerusalemite speaks up, and he notices Solomon's sedan chair, his palanquin. But whereas the second Jerusalemite just noticed it to notice that there were an honor guard around it, this one is particularly noticing his palanquin. And he says it's made of the wood of Lebanon. Now, Lebanon was a forest in the northern part of Israel and in Syria, the land north of Israel, and it provided very expensive wood. Lebanon means whiteness, or the white forest, and it had a particularly light-colored wood that was very famous, very expensive, out of which Solomon's sedan chair, the wooden parts of it anyway, were built. So Solomon the king made himself a palanquin, a sedan chair of the wood of Lebanon, and that wood was very impressive. We can tell from the fact that much of the temple was built from the cedars of Lebanon. Verse 10, he made its pillars of silver, its support of gold, its seat of purple, its interior paved with love by the daughters of Jerusalem. So he further describes the palanquin, the sedan chair. He says its pillars, its support poles, are made of silver. Of course, that's rich support poles. Then its support of gold. Now, this probably means the floor of the sedan chair. Now, we know that in the picture of the New Jerusalem, that the streets are paved with gold in the New Jerusalem. Well, Solomon's streets weren't quite paved with gold, but his sedan chair did have its floor made of gold. Then its seat, or its seat covering, is made of purple. And purple, we know, is the royal color. And the reason was that purple dye was very expensive. It was much more expensive than any other kind of dye. And so generally, only the very wealthy or kings could afford to have things dyed with purple. So Solomon's seat of his sedan chair is purple, very royal. And then its interior is paved with love. Well, you don't pave a sedan chair like we would think of pavement, but the word in Hebrew seems to mean checkered. So we imagine the walls and so forth are checkered. They're in a checkered pattern, and they were checkered, they were woven, in other words, with love by the daughters of Jerusalem. These would be the women of the capital city, who had helped in sewing the material, the cloth, for the inside of this palanquin, the sedan chair, and they'd done it with love for their king. Verse 11, go forth, O daughters of Zion, and see King Solomon with the crown with which his mother crowned him on the day of his wedding, the day of the gladness of his heart. So a fourth Jerusalemite now speaks up, and he calls on the women of the city, the daughters of Zion, to go out, to leave the city, and to watch as Solomon comes in, as his procession arrives. And he tries to entice them by what they'll see. They'll see King Solomon with a crown. So he has a new crown. Very exciting, a new crown that he has on his head. Now this crown was a special crown in that his mother had crowned him with it, Bathsheba. Solomon's mother had been there, and she had placed this crown on his head on the day of his wedding. And of course, that was his latest wedding. And as I told you before, Solomon was the groom in more weddings than most men will probably actually even attend in their whole lives. Solomon was the groom. He had 700 wives, 300 concubines. Well, imagine how many weddings Solomon was in where he was the groom. Well, on this latest wedding of his mother had given him this fancy crown, placed it on his head on the day of his wedding, the day of the gladness of his heart. So he says, come see this exciting new crown. So we've had four Jerusalemites, their perspective, what they're excited about. But notice what's lacking here. Notice what's missing. Notice what no one comments on. What's the one thing that you would expect people to comment on in seeing a bridal procession? On seeing the king return home from a wedding with his new queen? What would you expect people to comment on? Well, the bride, of course. The new queen being brought to her new home. You'd expect that that's what everybody would be looking at and commenting on. And yet, in this case, no one does. No one does. Well, that's not right. Every bride should be noticed in her new bridal procession, in her own bridal procession. Well, why isn't she noticed? Well, because no one cares. Think about how many wives Solomon has. Think about how many new brides he's brought home. Nobody cares about another new bride. Nobody cares. I mean, Solomon might as well bring home a new cow as a new bride. It would be just as special. Nobody cares about a new bride. That's what Solomon has done to weddings, to brides, to queenship, is he's made it just totally uninteresting. Nobody cares. Well, it doesn't sound like the greatest man to be married to, does it? Well, now we get to chapter 4. And in chapter 4, Solomon and his caravan have arrived, and it seems that our country girl and her shepherd boy betrothed lover meet again in Jerusalem. Remember, we saw that they met along the way to Jerusalem, and I suggested that probably some of Solomon's courtiers and court ladies had sympathized with this poor young country girl who was so brokenhearted about being snatched away by Solomon from her country boy betrothed. And they have decided to help her, and they perhaps help sneak him in. He finds out what's happened and follows her, and they help sneak him in for an interview with her. Well, it seems when they arrive at Jerusalem that he attains another interview. Now, the first time, Solomon had been distracted having dinner. Well, how was he distracted this time? Well, it doesn't tell us, but we can well imagine the king returning to his capital city after being gone for some time probably has a lot of business to take care of. There's a lot of chaos, a lot of things that require the king's attention. He doesn't have time to spend on this girl he's snatched away and plans on trying to entice to marry him. He's got other things to do. So she's out of his mind for this time, and so somehow her shepherd boy is able to sneak in, probably at personal risk to himself because the king wouldn't appreciate it if he found out he was there. So he's definitely risking his neck in some ways by doing this. But he attains an interview with her in Jerusalem. So chapter 4 and verse 1, the shepherd boy speaks. Behold, you are fair, my love. Behold, you are fair. You have dove's eyes behind your veil. Your hair is like a flock of goats going down from Mount Gilead. So her shepherd boy praises her. And again, he's probably excited and thrilled about the fact that she is remaining loyal to him in spite of what many would consider a better offer from the king. And so he praises her beauty. He says, you are beautiful, my love. You are fair. You are so lovely. Behold, you are fair. And then he describes her beauty. He describes her eyes. Now, it's translated dove's eyes, but it probably means your eyes are like doves. In other words, white, pure, innocent. Your eyes are like doves behind your veil. She's wearing a veil. Very modest girl. Very typical of their culture. She'd be wearing a veil. But her veil is see-through. He can see her eyes behind her veil. And he says, your eyes are like a dove behind your veil. Then he describes her hair. He says, your hair is like a flock of goats going down from Mount Gilead. Well, we can see here that this is a country boy. And she is a country girl. They're both very familiar with country things. Remember, she's familiar with goats. We've had that earlier in the book, describing her and goats. So apparently her family, we saw that they were vineyard keepers. And yet it seems they had a few goats, probably for their personal use, to get milk, to get cheese, and so forth from the goats. So she's familiar with goats, and he describes her hair like a flock of goats going down from Mount Gilead. So these are mountain goats, and they are leaping down from the mountains in great leaps. And probably her hair is the same way. It's kind of wavy hair going down her shoulders and down her back in waves, just like goats jumping down from the mountains. So he describes her this way. Verse 2, your teeth are like a flock of shorn sheep, which have come up from the washing, every one of which bears twins, and none is barren among them. Well, here we see his own specialty. Of course, he is a shepherd boy, and so he is very familiar with sheep. So he compares her teeth to sheep. Now, he describes them as shorn sheep. And of course, sheep, when they're a long way from being shorn, their wool grows, it gets bushy, it gets shaggy. But her teeth aren't that way. They're like sheep newly shorn. So nice and clipped, short hair, look very nice. And then they have come up from the washing. Now sheep, we imagine them out in the fields, out in the wilderness. Their nice white wool probably gets very dirty. Probably gets smeared with brown, smeared with color. Not so white anymore at all. But then you take them to the washing, and what do they look like when they come up from the washing? Well, very nice and beautifully white. And so he says your teeth are nice like a flock of shorn sheep. Nice, clipped, even. They've come from the washing, so they're beautiful and white. Every one of them bears twins, and none is barren among them. In other words, none of your teeth are missing. None of them are out of place. Everyone has its partner in its right place. None is barren. Well, in their day, I don't know how good their dental work was. Maybe not so good, so maybe this was a commendable thing, that she has all her teeth, they're all in the right place. They're all in rows, they're none missing. Might not always be the case if their dentistry was not that good. But she has beautiful teeth, and he describes them. Then verse 3, your lips are like a strand of scarlet, and your mouth is lovely. Your temples behind your veil are like a piece of pomegranate. So he describes her beautiful lips. He says they're like a strand, like a thread of scarlet. A beautiful scarlet thread in her face. Then he says her mouth is lovely. She has a beautiful mouth. Not just the teeth, but the mouth itself is lovely. And then he describes her temples, or maybe more likely her cheeks. Her temples behind her veil are like a piece of pomegranate. So maybe you imagine a pomegranate cut in half, and one on each side, her two cheeks. Then verse 4, your neck is like the Tower of David, built for an armory, on which hang 1,000 bucklers, all shields of mighty men. Now, while this country boy is much more familiar with country things and country figures, well, right now he's at Jerusalem. And one of the most impressive sights at Jerusalem was probably the Tower of David. He had maybe passed it on his way to see her. She had maybe passed it on her way to the palace. And maybe they're even standing in a room with a window where they can look out and see the Tower of David. So he describes her neck like the Tower of David, built for an armory. Strong, firm, that's her neck. Then he says, on which hang 1,000 bucklers, all shields of mighty men. Well, of course, that's the Tower of David. Probably has a lot of weaponry attached to it, but he's describing her neck because of probably all the necklaces that are hanging around it. Remember, we saw that Solomon had bestowed a whole bunch of jewelry on her, trying to say, hey, look, I'm a king. Look at all the jewelry I can give you. Every woman likes jewelry, right? And I can give you all this jewelry if you'll just marry me and forget that country boy of yours. So her neck is hung with 1,000 necklaces. Maybe somewhat exaggerated, but there's a lot of them on there, no doubt. Then verse 5, your two breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle, which feed among the lilies. So he praises her breasts. He compares them to two fawns, twins of a gazelle, a deer-like creature. And they are feeding among the lilies. So he praises her breasts this way. Now some of these figures, Solomon uses similar ones. But probably a lot of these things were common among young men, how they would praise their young women. The shepherd boy is not necessarily making these things all up himself. He's maybe using some of his knowledge in how he's describing sheep. And he gives more details about some of these things than Solomon does. But some of the figures he uses are the same as what Solomon uses. That's probably because they're not original. They're just things that go around among the young men. Kind of clever things to say to your young lady, ways to praise her. Verse 6, until the day breaks and the shadows flee away, I will go my way to the mountain of myrrh and to the hill of frankincense. Well, this seems to be the girl answering him. And she begs him to stay with her that night until the day breaks and the shadows flee away. She probably feels very lonely, very frightened here in Jerusalem, the big city, away from everyone she knows, taken there by Solomon, who wants to snatch her away from her life, like it or not, snatch her away from her beloved, marry her himself. She's frightened. She wants him to stay. So she says, stay until the day breaks and the shadows flee away. I will go to the mountain of myrrh and to the hill of frankincense. Remember, we already saw in chapter 1 that to her, her beautiful odor is her beloved. So she wants that odor to stay with her until the day. Then he replies, verse 7, you are all fair, my love, and there is no spot in you. So I don't know, he probably would have kept going describing her. He's been going from her head down, got down to her breast, maybe would have kept on going, but she interrupted. And so he stops there and just sums her up completely, that she is completely beautiful from head to toe, from top to bottom, front to back, every bit about her is beautiful. He says, there is no spot in you. Remember, that's how the Lord longs to present his ecclesia, his church to himself, is with no spot or wrinkle or blemish or any such thing. We read that in the book of Ephesians. And that's how this shepherd boy views his beloved. Then verse 8, he says, come with me from Lebanon, my spouse, with me from Lebanon. Look from the top of Amana, from the top of Senir and Hermon, from the lion's dens, from the mountains of the leopards. So he suggests that they flee away. He's maybe figuring at some point she'll be able to get away and come with him. Or maybe he's wishing that they could sneak out just then. Like I said, if there was a window there, maybe they're gazing out longingly, wishing they could be out there and away from this captivity she's in Jerusalem. Now he calls her his spouse. But remember, as we discussed, she was a betrothed spouse. Now our tendency would be to compare betrothal, like they had in Israel, to engagement. But it was really more than that, like I told you last time. That when you were betrothed, you actually went through a legally binding ceremony. And from then on, you were a couple. You were a betrothed husband and a betrothed wife, just not a married husband, not a married wife. And it would actually take a divorce to end a betrothal. Of course, no such thing is true of an engagement like we have it today. The woman can just give the ring back, or the man just say he wants the ring back, and it's all over. There's nothing legal about an engagement. But a betrothal was legal. It would often be arranged by the parents. Could be sometimes even before the couple had hit puberty. The woman could be maybe 10 years old. The man may be 12 or 13. He's usually a couple years older. But they're not ready to get married. They're betrothed, and what they do is that the man goes out and prepares to support himself, to learn a business. The woman goes, learns how to run a household, how to take care of children, how to cook, how to clean, all those sort of things, how to command the servants. And then when their parents decide they're ready, then they come together and are married. And the marriage ceremony could actually be less formal and less important than the betrothal ceremony. So they are betrothed, but the pickle they're in is that when you're betrothed, either family can call for a divorce. And they could do it, and the couple could not even have any say in it. So Solomon is probably planning to go to her brothers and entice them with a better offer to end her betrothal to her country boy and betroth her instead to Solomon. And they could do that as long as they were a betrothed couple and not a married one. So that's the difficulty that this couple is in. They would never agree to a divorce. But her brothers, who have already seemed less than sympathetic toward her, might do it without any say from her at all. Now he says, come with me from Lebanon. Well, they weren't in Lebanon. They were in Solomon's palace. But Solomon's palace used cedar from Lebanon. And there's probably so much cedar there, there was like being in the White Forest. He's comparing it to being there. There's so much cedar there. Now, the top of Amana. Amana means support. And it was a mountainous area from which a river flows. So they're up on the hill of Hermon, and he wants her to come away with him from there. He says, from the top of Senir and Hermon. Senir means the snow mountain, and it was the old Amorite name for Mount Hermon, which means a sanctuary. And Jerusalem was built on two mountaintops, Mount Hermon and Mount Zion. And it seems that Solomon's palace, where they are anyway, the place where she is being kept, is on Mount Hermon. And he wants to flee from there. Then from the lion's dens, from the mountains of the leopards. Well, there's no doubt that the lions and the leopards are Solomon and his noblemen. He says, we need to get away from all these lions and leopards and get back to the country where we belong. So we see in this portion the return of Solomon to Jerusalem, and that his shameless polygamy has removed the specialness of marriage, of wifehood, and of queenship from Israel. How do we view marriage? Do we honor the glory of being a wife? Now the girl shepherd's betrothed risks himself to come to her, and he praises her. Do we long for our shepherd Lord to come to us the same way our Lord Jesus Christ? Well, I pray that we do.
This story was written to illuminate the kind of love that God had for Israel and the love he desired from them in return. It is also a poignant lesson for us today because we have lost the understanding of this kind of love in our culture, for God and for each other. Thank you, Nathan, for your lesson on the return of Solomon. On our next program, Nathan will continue his teaching series in the book of the Song of Solomon with The Desperate Plan. Thank you for joining us today. We trust that you are learning that the more we study God's Word, the more we can know God. For more information on the program, to hear past programs, and for other downloadable material that Nathan has produced, please visit our website at knowinggodintheword.org. For more Bible study literature by Nathan and other Bible teachers, including Seed and Bread Bible studies, please visit the Word of Truth Ministry at seedandbread.org. I'm your host, Bob Juno, with Bible teacher Nathan Johnson. We'll say so long for now, but we look forward to you joining us next week on Knowing God in the Word.